You're listening to The Naked Pravda. This is Medusa's first and only English language podcast, so please don't be shy about recommending us to your friends and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're tuning in. Welcome to The Naked Pravda, a podcast that highlights how Medusa's top reporting intersects with the wider research and expertise that exists about Russia. I'm your host, Kevin Rothrock, the managing editor of Medusa's English language edition, and on today's show, we'll be discussing business journalism in Russia with Max Sedin, a Moscow correspondent for the Financial Times, or FT, and a former reporter with BuzzFeed and the Associated Press. He's reported from Russia, Ukraine, and across Europe and the former Soviet Union, and he recently wrote a story about the newsroom scandal at Vedomosti, which dovetails with a lot of reporting by Medusa, including a joint investigative report released after this interview this week by Medusa, Forbes Russia, The Bell, and Vedomosti itself, about how the oil giant Rosneft has apparently trapped Vedomosti in a ridiculously circuitous ownership matrix, while the nominal owner, Demyan Kudryavtsev, has managed to earn a bundle of money. As I said, this interview with Max Sedin was recorded before Medusa and all those other outlets released that investigative report, but it was recorded after the Naked Pravda's own interview in early April with Maxim Trudelyubov, Vedomosti's editor at large. If you didn't read the new investigative report, it's long, or if you didn't listen to the show with Trudelyubov, it's not as long, or maybe it's longer, depends on how quickly you read. If those two things are true, you might be asking yourself, what is the scandal with Vedomosti? The short version is that one of Russia's top business newspapers is possibly being sold to new owners, and the paper recently got a new acting editor-in-chief whose obnoxiousness and penchant for censorship have alienated the newsroom to the degree that senior editors are publishing open letters and editorials denouncing this guy, whose name is Andrei Shmarov. But what is Vedomosti exactly? It first hit newsstands in September 1999. With equal shares, the newspaper's co-founders included the Russian company Independent Media, created by the Dutch journalist and businessman Derek Sauer, the British media company FT Group, which published the Financial Times, and the American company Dow Jones, the Wall Street Journal's publisher. In 2005, Derek Sauer and his partners sold Independent Media, including its 33% stake in Vedomosti, to the Finnish publishing house Sanoma. In 2015, Sanoma sold its third of Vedomosti to a company associated with the family of Demyan Kudryavtsev, who worked as CEO of the Kommersant publishing house from 2006 to 2012. In late 2015, after Russia started enforcing new regulations that limit foreign ownership in Russian media outlets to just 20%, the remaining foreign owners of Vedomosti sold their shares to Demyan Kudryavtsev and his co-investors. Now, the multi-million dollar question, did Kudryavtsev and his partners have enough money independently to buy Vedomosti? Yes, but that is not what they did. A joint investigation by journalists from Medusa, Forbes Russia, The Bell, and Vedomosti has discovered that the newspaper was acquired using entirely borrowed funds, meaning that it was essentially pledged. Since 2017, the oil giant Rosneft has controlled this debt. Now, this gets enormously complicated, but the gist is this. After acquiring the offshore company that owns Vedomosti's publisher, Kudryavtsev resold the offshore to his wife's company for more than twice as much money as he and his partners paid for it in the first place, netting himself more than $15 million in profit while saddling his wife's company with more than $25 million. The loan came from Gazprom Bank, but the debt was later bought by a dummy corporation using a loan from a Rosneft bank. Long story short, Rosneft now controls Vedomosti's publisher through a debt chain wherein no enterprise in this string is capable of repaying its loans, and it is now impossible to sell shares in Vedomosti without repaying the debts accrued by Kudryavtsev because they're integrated, meaning that Vedomosti's potential buyers, whoever they are, whoever they will be, will have to resolve this issue in order to complete the purchase. Earlier this spring, Kudryavtsev announced that he and his partners were selling the newspaper to the entrepreneurs Konstantin Zatkov and Alexei Golubovich. Under the influence of Rosneft, which wants as badly to get rid of Kudryavtsev as Kudryavtsev wants his debts paid off, Andrei Shmarov was appointed the paper's new acting editor-in-chief. He has been a nightmare from day one, and as a result, Alexei Golubovich has actually walked away from the whole deal. But the sale is apparently still going through with just Zetkov. So that is the hell reporters at Vedomosti have had to face for months now. This is life for business journalists in Russia today.
Well, basically, reading between the lines, what is fairly safe to assume has happened here? And if you talk to reporters of Vedomosti, they will say the same thing.
This, by the way, folks, is Max Sedin, the Financial Times journalist I mentioned at the top of today's show.
So it is normal for, you know, when an important media asset is being sold, that you know, as with most major business deals in Russia, that is going to require some sort of level of approval from the right people.
Max is talking here about Andrei Shmarov, Vedomosti's new acting editor-in-chief, whose tenure at the newspaper has been, as I've said already, an absolute nightmare. When he introduced himself to the newsroom, for example, he touted his ignorance about Vedomosti's own code of ethics, he professed not to read the newspaper itself, and then he defended Harvey Weinstein and expressed skepticism about the very concept of sexual harassment. After a series of attempts by the new acting editor-in-chief to influence the paper's editorial practices, in favor of Rosneft, by the way, the newsroom nominated its own replacement for Shmarov in an editorial published at Vedomosti itself, where senior staff defended the publication's values and principles.
He seems to have friends in the right places. He's friends with Mikhail Leontiev, who's the press secretary of Rosneft, the giant oil company. He's said that publicly, that they're friends. And what has happened is that his tenure has been so disastrous and such a drastic departure from everything that Vedomosti was always associated with, that no one wants to take responsibility for it. But at the same time, no one wants to admit, because this would be a violation of the rules of the game, where his appointment really came from, which is why they're accusing each other of still controlling the newspaper and having appointed this guy. And no one seems to know, including Shmarov himself, who signed off. And in that case, I think that's a point where you start looking up the chain. Now, the reason this was such a shock was because out of all Russian media, business or no, the most respectable Russian publications over the last few years, gradually they were taken over by Kremlin-friendly oligarchs. Some of them dramatically fired editors and had staff quit en masse. At others, the changes were more gradual. But there was this general imposition of censorship over much of the print and online media, which is why Medusa exists, among others. And Vedomosti was always set apart from that because they were co-owned by the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal. And this was the sort of gold star that they had that really defined the brand. So we have, you know, the same editorial standards as these very lofty Western publications, and they own us, which means that, you know, we can tell oligarchs who complain to go screw themselves. When Tatiana Lisova, who's now your colleague at Medusa, when she left Vedomosti, where she was the editor in 2016, a lot of Vedomosti staff posted on Facebook their favorite stories about when she'd told various oligarchs to go screw themselves, and they were complaining about articles. And then 5 years ago, Russia changed the law essentially to get at the likes of Vedomosti and Forbes, which was then owned by Axel Springer. They don't have that anymore. So, I mean, this is a danger that the publication as a whole is in, and this is why it's threatening the deal, because the whole value, if you are a prospective buyer, is in this Vedomosti brand that's still residually associated with the FT and the Wall Street Journal. They have the orangey pink salmon colored newsprint that still looks like the FT. In most readers' minds, you know, most people, you know, in the business world have been reading it since very, very early in the FT and Wall Street Journal's ownership. And if you start immediately violating that and doing it in this very old school rough and tumble way, the way that Shmarov has, then it basically degrades the value of the Vyedomosti name in the eyes of reporters and, as far as I know, a lot of readers, some of whom have already demanded their subscriptions repaid.
Is it typical that businesses or business interests would be reluctant to turn to the Kremlin, even if they're technically trying to do the Kremlin's bidding? Because this seems like something that has popped up repeatedly, say after the annexation of Crimea. You know, there were certain expectations of people with lots of assets to kind of take a hit and make certain investments in Crimea, even if it exposed them to potentially to sanctions in the West. This has happened with the sale or the distribution of IP addresses to businesses in Crimea that were suddenly left without, you know, their what they had previously under the Ukrainian authorities. And I believe it's happened with soccer too, if I'm not mistaken.
One common misconception that a lot of people have about how Russia works is that because Putin personally and the Kremlin have absolute power and very wide-ranging control of what's going on, that they are the ones deciding who is doing what and making all these decisions, even at fairly low levels that have to be agreed with Putin. And what you actually get is a system when you have that much power concentrated at the top with no checks on it. You get a system that's much more like the emperor, about, you know, Haile Selassie of Ethiopia by Kapuscinski, which is really an allegory for communist rule in Poland. The system is actually extremely inefficient because it's just not physically possible. You know, even if you are the much more bureaucratically efficient and technologically advanced Chinese Communist Party, it's just very difficult to have that kind of control over every single article that goes in the newspaper, for example. And so what happens is that people, and including at surprisingly very high levels on relatively important things, are often left to interpret signals rather than getting direct orders. So you mentioned soccer in Crimea. What actually happened there was, if you want to understand Russia, all you have to do is read the leaked transcript of the meeting of the Russian Soccer League board when they had to vote on whether to accept the Crimean teams into the Russian from Ukraine and into the Russian Soccer League or not after the annexation. And so the argument for was, yes, we are patriots. Crimea is Russia. They must play with us. We will put up through any sanctions. But then the flip side is, oh, but wait a minute. You know, I own, you know, this very big company. It'll be very difficult for all my employees if my company is under sanctions. And what if they do something that takes the World Cup away, and that's Putin's personal achievement? We can't do anything about that. And then so at some point during this meeting, someone says, well, wait a minute, why don't we just call Putin and ask him what he wants us to do? And they all go, oh, no, 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 no. That's a terrible idea. Don't do that. Way too scary. And in the end, if you look at Crimea and all the big state companies do not operate in Crimea. There's no Sberbank in Crimea. There's no VTB bank in Crimea. The banks in Crimea are all under a total U.S. embargo. They can't be part of the international banking system. And this is an occasional source of anger somewhere like Crimea, where, you know, people say, why can't we have Sberbank? You know, that's a good bank. Why do we have to have these weird local sanctioned banks? But Sberbank wouldn't be able to operate the way it does as this big global financial institution if operating in Crimea. So while, you know, of course you would only get brownie points for investing there, the Kremlin also understands that the strictures that you're under if you're a businessman with some sort of profile.
There was a recent essay that Meduza published by Vyedomosti editor-at-large Maxim Trudolyubov, where he says that Vyedomosti's newsroom right now kind of finds itself caught between, you know, its problematic owners, which we've been talking about, and also criticism from what he calls the ascetics and the cynics, which by that he means the pundits that say the newspaper staff members have either, you know, sold out, that they're motivated only by their mortgage, you know, that they've got to pay the bills, or that they're clinging to unrealistic ideals. And, you know, I'm sure that you've encountered both of that in when just looking at social media, because this is by no means restricted to either Vedomosti or Russia. And in Max's essay, he goes into details about the Wall Street Journal and the South China Morning Post with their sort of newsroom ownership controversies. Now, without getting into anything personal, does that sentiment resonate with you at all? I mean, I'm sitting here in Connecticut, you know, working for Medusa, translating podcasting content about Russia. And even here, I get, you know, I feel exhausted by the hostility that I can see directed at journalists in Russia, which is where I'm looking. And even though I appreciate the need for kind of a never-ending conversation about ethics, but I wonder, that argument or that essay by Max, what do you think about it?
What you're seeing here is this attempt sometimes to present this dichotomy between censorship, which is when the government stops you from writing something, and self-censorship, which is where you don't even try to do things that might offend powerful people because you might be scared of the various consequences for that. And self-censorship is obviously a problem. If you talk to some reporters at Vedomosti who I spoke to for this piece, there's definitely a sense that if you compare Vedomosti now to before, you know, back in the day when it was owned by Cohen, by the FT and Journal, you definitely don't see as many big daring investigations as you used to. And you would probably ascribe that more to self-censorship than censorship. It's something that happened at RBC, which is Vedomosti's biggest competitor, a few years ago when there was a similar scandal. A lot of the staff quit. And then the new editor said, you know, we have to be wary of the double yellow line. And no one knows where that is. And that's something that I don't think is unique to journalism. That's certainly not unique to Russia. What you, I think, gets lost in this is that it's not really a either or question, because obviously if you have things like been happening at Vedomosti for the last few weeks, where you have very obvious instances of direct censorship, whether or not they were done at the behest of the Kremlin, these things are obviously worse, because it's still possible to put forward to put out some sort of decent publication. I think there are lots of, and this is one of the advantages of the business world, because the people who buy and read business publications are usually people in business themselves. This is also why Marxists like reading the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, you will find, because the information in the news sections as both the capitalists and the anti-capitalists see it is relatively free of ideology and bias.
I don't know if there's like a saying among leftists, but it's like, if you want to read the most accurate reporting about the dregs or the downfall of capitalism, you have to turn to the Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times. Like, there's some kind of wisdom like that. Is that, I think I've heard that. You must have too.
The former editor of the FT, he even gave an interview to one of the Chapo Trap House people last year, the number one kind of dirtbag bro podcast. And it was all about how much he loved the FT. And I can't stand reading the New York Times, but the FT is, you know, so much more unvarnished. And so if you look at Russia and also other various authoritarian countries where there still is something of a business press, there is at least some sort of interest in having a functioning business media that is relatively apolitical. And it's all the more important in a country like Russia, where, and this is also how I got into it, and the country doesn't have real politics for the most part. And it's when public politics is basically a show, it's a pretty dull and depressing show. All the interesting things happen behind the scenes. Then that means that the real politics often happens elsewhere, and especially in Russia, when the economy is so dominated by the state, you often see these battles playing out about how the country is run, not in the Duma, which is this completely pliant organ, but within these various factions of the elite that are reflected in what you read in the business pages. And if you don't have that, then you don't have anything. It's why business publications were allowed to survive for a lot longer than just strictly political ones were in Russia. And, you know, even well after 2014, you would have RBC as a great example. They did several investigations into Putin's family, and it wasn't until they'd done quite a few of them that one of the editors was fired.
I'm sure you don't welcome it, but it's almost as if in a few years, the only business reporting will be Western journalists who are based in Moscow.
Well, not necessarily. One of the other things about the likes of Vyedomosti and their competitors is, and this is something why it's also a real challenge trying to keep up their standards, is that their best reporters all get poached by the business wires, Reuters and Bloomberg, that pay, you know, exponentially more than you could ever earn working as a Russian journalist. And it's a real challenge for the likes of us because we have much smaller staff. The FT Bureau has 3 reporters. The Reuters and Bloomberg bureaus each have more than 20, if I'm not mistaken. And so many of their best reporters, they hire from Vyedomosti. I compete with a lot of them with the various business and economic things that I cover. And it's really, I'm very pleased, never managed to beat them to anything because they just have such an amazing talent pool to draw from. So, I mean, the question is, I think what we've seen here is that if you look at what's happened to RBC, a lot of the best reporters left and have gone to various other places. They don't do big investigations about Putin's family anymore. But it's also it's not the worst publication. You know, obviously, you know, this is the censorship. There's a reason why, you know, dozens of the best reporters left, right? Because they didn't want to work under those conditions. But it's not, you know, the complete disaster that you had with what's happening at Vyedomosti, where what Andrei Shmarov has done in a few weeks has been sufficient that the deal that made him the editor is basically blowing up. Because this is seen as too much. And, you know, they would, one thing that a few sources have suggested to me is that now that it's been so bad and it's actually calling the financial health of the newspaper into question, what might happen is some sort of excuse will be found to possibly remove him. And then he will be replaced with some sort of more subtle editor who will be someone that the Kremlin is happy to deal with, but is also someone who, won't be doing things as drastic as outright bans on reporting on politically sensitive topics or taking down articles that offend important and powerful people. If you talk to people who work at Vyedomosti, what they're really worried about is that they don't think that the Kremlin really recognizes this anymore, which is how this guy was able to get his job in the first place. Because, you know, so politics has been taboo for the better part of a decade now, and most business in Russia is controlled by the state. If you're not allowed to write things that upset state companies, then you're only really left with small business. And at the current rate of going in the coronavirus crisis, unless they get a lot more help from the government, there's not going to be a whole lot of small business left when this is all said and done. And so there's going to be nothing in the paper. And it's very difficult to operate in that ecosystem when the main companies that you're writing about are so hostile to you. There are several state companies who have pulled their advertising from places like Vyedomosti and cost some pretty significant revenue streams because they were upset at different articles. So if you start to see that advertising trickling back, then that may be a sign that they've reached some sort of accommodation.
Earlier in this interview, Max said that Russia doesn't have politics in the traditional sense. There are political parties and elections, obviously, but they don't really determine the distribution of power or agenda setting. To get a good sense of these things in Russia, Max says you've got to look at the business reporting by Russian journalists.
These are really where the battles are played out of how Russia is run between your ministries, your big state oil and gas companies, the oligarchs, the banks, and that has been by far the best understanding you can get of how power really works, because it's the only real, tangible thing you can get in Russia today that really spills to the surface. You can really talk to all these guys. And you often learn a lot more about Putin and the Kremlin from talking to business people and oligarchs than you would from talking to, you know, the same old political scientists, and say nothing of all these doomed deputies.
Is the field very accessible? I mean, are people willing to actually speak to journalists? Because I know that you know, one of the difficulties of reporting on these stories is that it's just difficult to get access. Like, one of the criticisms that was made of the BBC's recent profile of Venediktov, where he, you know, he's accused of sexual harassment by multiple women, is that he's an easy target. And this is what Echo of Moscow staff have seen said on Facebook. The implication being they should have gone after Sechin or somebody else. And as lame as that argument is, it does sort of make me wonder, is it possible to do very significant reporting on people like that? Because that's certainly what we're talking about. It's like that would be the kind of like most hard hitting journalism that I could imagine in Russia. Is it possible to do that kind of thing? Not just in terms of what the censors will allow or self censorship will allow, but are there actually people who will talk on the record about that kind of stuff?
There are. I think you have to compare it by degree. So if you compare the business press, the kind of access that we get, to the, dare I say, mainstream media, we actually get, by the standards of Western publications, we get pretty good access. And, you know, there are various, you know, you spend enough time doing it, there are enough, you know, state company CEOs, oligarchs who will, you know, give you their personal phone numbers. You'll meet them without the press people, go to their house, and they'll tell you some gossipy things about what's going on. That's the vast majority of that is off the record. We sometimes have an issue because we are foreigners at the end of the day. So, you know, some people see that as more trustworthy because, you know, a lot of these companies, in our case, you know, they have including the big state companies like, you know, Rosneft, Sberbank, VTB, Gazprom, they all are listed on the London Stock Exchange. You know, there's still some interest in talking to us. At the same time, sometimes they feel more comfortable talking to Russian journalists, and that is where, you know, for the most part, the main audience for their businesses is quite a lot. And also with the Russian media, there is the practice in Russian media that's something that basically doesn't exist in the English speaking media, that you are allowed to check your quotes after the fact. You are allowed to approve what doesn't go out under your name. This is completely taboo in the West, but this is something that actually most of the rest of Europe is quite common practice. So if I sound like I'm describing some sort of nefarious Russian censorship practice, just bear in mind that that's also completely common in somewhere like Germany.
On the subject of business journalism, to get a better sense of the potential impact of reporting in this field, I asked Max if he could remember any moments when his journalism had a specific real-world impact. He recalled an interview he did with the Ukrainian oligarch Igor Kolomoisky after Zelensky's presidential election, where Kolomoisky advocated defaulting on Ukraine's IMF debt, which led to a partial devaluation of Ukraine's currency. It's a good story, and it's certainly related to business journalism. But then Max told me another story about Steven Seagal, and that's the one I want you to hear.
One thing that I did do back when I was a BuzzFeed, I think actually may have had something in effect, though I have no way of knowing for sure, was actually about Steven Seagal. We did the story about how why Steven Seagal was friends with Putin, and the lead news nugget in the story was that Putin had actually asked Obama for Steven Seagal to become an honorary consul of Russia in Arizona, where he lives, and he was some sort of unofficial envoy between the White House and the Kremlin. And this never happened. We were writing about it two years later. And this was back in the day when you could still call up Dmitry Peskov, Putin's spokesman, and he would just talk to you for a few minutes about stuff and give you some quotes you could use for your story. And he said, well, I don't know when the next meeting between Steven Seagal and Vladimir Putin will be. There are certainly no meetings planned for the near future. And I don't know any intentions by the president to change that. And so then when we sent our final list of questions to Steven Seagal, we said, you know, the Putin spokesman has said that he's now planning to meet with you in the future, that he's very busy, he may not have time to do this. You know, how does that make you feel? And then before the article even came out, But after we sent these questions, Steven Seagal, for the first time in a while, suddenly appeared in Moscow, and he would be seen. People would keep sending me all these social media posts that people take selfies with him in the lobby of the Ritz, right by the Kremlin. And then he didn't leave the country for about 6 months. And appeared to a casual observer like he was lobbying for some sort of meeting. And eventually, I remember this well. It was on my birthday. He did get to meet Putin again, and he and Pamela Anderson toured the new aquarium in Vladivostok with Putin. And then eventually, about a year and a half after our story came out, Putin gave him a Russian passport, and he became this sort of he's a special representative of Russia for cultural liaison between the United States and Russia or something like that. And I remember writing to Rosie Gray, my former colleague who I did the original story with, see, you wanted journalism because you wanted to change the world. You wanted to do stories that have impact. And look what we did. Steven Seagal finally got his Russian passport. He's friends with Putin again.
You've been listening to The Naked Pravda, a podcast that highlights how Meduza's top reporting intersects with the wider research and expertise that exists about Russia. On today's show, we heard from FT Moscow correspondent Max Sedin about the ins and the outs of business reporting in Russia and the drama at Vedomosti, one of Russia's best but struggling business newspapers. The Naked Pravda is a podcast from Meduza. It's our first English language show, and I hope you recommend us to your friends and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're tuning in to help put this program in front of more people. Thank you for listening, and come back soon.